fine friends. Welcome back to Destination Discourse. I'm your host, Stuart Butler. Joined today in person, once again, live from Myrtle Beach. Well, not live when you hear it, but in Myrtle Beach, Adam Stoker.
Hi, Stuart.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm disappointed there was no name shtick this time. You guessed my middle name last time. You didn't replace it with something new.
Well, you know what's interesting? I was going to actually publish this episode before that episode, so now you completely broke the fourth wall and ruined the continuity.
And this is why you should communicate with your co-host.
We only talk to each other when we're recording. Yeah. We never talk other times. So maybe I will, maybe I won't. So okay. If I publish this before, then people know that at some point we did crack the code. But if not, this conversation will make no sense.
I'm excited to see which direction you choose.
Either way, we disappoint our audience, as per usual.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, glad you're in Myrtle Beach. I know you had some work to do here with one of our partner companies, Gulf Tourism Solutions. So we figured we'd take the opportunity to have a conversation. And yeah. No Stu's News today, unless you want to sing a jingle.
You know, I'll pass today. I feel sure. Like, yeah, I did that once.
Did you listen back to it?
It was really bad.
It was epic, is what it was. Yeah. If any Desties want to clip that out and just turn it into a meme, that would be greatly appreciated.
If somebody clips that and sends it to me, I will play it as one of the Stu's News jingles in a future episode.
Okay.
Yeah, well, but not you. It can't be you.
Okay. Challenge accepted. I got a feeling Caleb or Nate, one of the super Desties, will do that. That'd be good.
If they do it, it's worth it for me.
Yeah. So this, I'm having a little hard time with this episode.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to get a little vulnerable, but I want to sort of think through some stuff. So to set this up.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
If you're intending to get a little vulnerable.
Yeah.
How comfortable are you with giving you a hard time throughout?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
making
good.
Fun is my love language.
All right.
It's totally acceptable. But I recently gave an opening keynote at a conference, and it was for Newport Hospitality.
Okay.
And it's the first time in a long time I've talked to a hotel group instead of a DMO group, right? And a lot of times when I'm doing sessions, spoken at a lot of conferences, right? But I've never done like a big opening keynote, like setting the standard for the entire summit or conference. And I took it super seriously. And
As opposed to
just sort of winging it like I usually do, right? Like okay. If we do a Destination Discourse live, let's be honest, there's not a lot of prep work goes into that. We'll figure out some questions.
I mean, I rehearse a lot, but I've noticed that you...
Well, that's totally fair.
Yeah, don't
But,
prepare.
You know, when you have this much natural talent, it's fine. You can get away with winging it. But I did it on a topic called Scrappy Always Wins.
Okay.
And you've heard me refer to Scrappy a lot, right? And I'm not the only one that uses the term Scrappy. A lot of people use this term different ways. But for this talk, I really wanted to articulate with clarity what I meant by Scrappy. Mm-hmm. Because I think it can mean different things to different people. And so Scrappy Always Wins is what it was. And I used Claude Cowork to help me sort of plan it. And I used ChatGPT. And I was back and forth between these. And I just sort of threw in some of my life stories, and I threw in, like, just a verbal diarrhea, like, with my – I actually used ChatGPT where I just used the dictation function and just talked to it and said, hey, I'm thinking this. And I really workshopped it. And, like, okay. And I actually think I got to a point where there's some value here, and I want to share it with you. The audience, I did the keynote on Monday, went super well, was okay. Really happy, got a lot of great feedback. But I want to stress test it with you because I think it's a framework that could really help our entire industry.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's about being scrappy, and it's about scrappy always wins. So I'm not going to do the keynote, right, because this is more of a conversation, but I'm going to sort of walk you through the beats.
Yeah.
And I'll let you sort of jump in wherever you feel. Does
okay.
That sound good?
Let's do it.
And I don't know how long this is going to last because it was like originally it was like a – when I timed myself, it was like an hour and 20 minutes. And I had to cut it down to 45 minutes. So I had to cut out a ton. I might bring some of that back in today. I got my phone with me just so I can see the slides so I remember the beats. But I started talking about how disruption is coming, right?
Yeah.
Like there's no question we know disruption is coming. And I think we're going to see more disruption in the next 3 years than any of us have seen in our lifetime. We've talked about that ad nauseum on the show. And I think there's times in your life when – you're at a point of no return, and the world that you knew is no longer exists, and you've got to approach it in a different way. I think we're at one of those moments now, right? think we've got to value things like agility and scrappiness, and I'll talk about that. So in the keynote, I actually opened up a little bit about my history. And, you know, the Desties know that I have visual impairment, right? I've talked about that. I'm not shy about talking about it. But I actually went into more detail in this, right? And I opened up. I mean, I've never done that publicly before.
Well, you've actually never told me. Okay. So I'm interested to hear some of this.
Yeah. So I was born with severe myopia, right, which essentially is short-sightedness. Without corrective lenses, I can't see past the end of my nose. I literally can't. I wear contact lenses now. But growing up in working-class family in Southeast England, we didn't have access to a lot of resources, and the National Health Service isn't that great. And so I literally couldn't see past my nose for the first 3 years of my life. Didn't have any kind of corrective lenses until I was 3 years old.
Wow.
And so I would literally watch TV with my nose pressed against the TV screen. And my mom knew there was a problem, but we didn't have the resources to do anything about it. And so when I turned 3 years old, finally got my first glasses, you know, big, thick Coke bottle glasses, and I could see for the first time. And I left the hospital because that's where you had to go back then. And I'd ask my mom questions like, what's that? And she'd be like, that's an ambulance. And I'd say, what's that? And she says, it's a mailbox. I'd say, what's that weird looking thing there? She said, that's your dad. So that's a good joke.
He loves
right?
that joke.
That's a good joke. But the truth is, I didn't really know what people looked like. And I'd run up and I'd touch their faces and stuff. So, like, for the first, I think in part, this is why my brain works the way it does, because I can really visualize things in my head really well. And it may be because the first 3 years of my life, I literally couldn't see past my nose. Hmm. Everything else was a blur. So, fast forward about 2 or 3 years, as 5 or 6 years old, all of a sudden I just stopped working. I put down the pen in school, and I was a good student. I was a very enthusiastic student, probably a little too much energy, probably asked too many questions. But I just stopped working one day, and the teacher pulled my mom in, and my mom was like, what's going on? Why are you not working? And it turned out what had happened was there was a lady had come in to do colorblind tests for everyone. And so, you know, the colorblind tests where there's like a little circle of dots, I can't see any of them. So it turns out, in addition to myopia, I also have a form of cone dystrophy. And cone dystrophy is the cones in your eye are what helps you differentiate colors, right? And so okay. I'm severely colorblind, and it's a degenerative disease as well. And so,
does that mean you see color less and less over time?
Yeah, potentially.
Okay.
Right? But I mean, I can sort of tell the difference between lights and darks, but like if you show me a bunch of greens, browns, reds, pinks, like I... greens, reds. Like Mario Kart's really hard for me because I don't know if I got a green or a red shell. So sometimes I think it's red and I'm all excited and I fire and it just goes in a straight line and I get really pissed because I missed the person. But the person doing the test, who should never be allowed to, probably don't now, they're probably long retired because a long time ago, but they should never be allowed to talk to kids again because they told me I wouldn't be able to do any of the things I wanted to do. Because at the time I was five, and I wanted to be a fireman or a policeman or an army man, right? The things. And they're like, oh, you're not going to be able to do any of that.
Ugh.
And so I, as a 5-6-year-old kid, was like, well, what's the point, right? And I just literally stopped working. And so my mom taught me such a valuable lesson at this point. She sat me down and said, listen, I don't care what she says. You can do anything you want to do. If you want to work for the police or the army, there are jobs there you can do, right? And there'll be jobs in the future that don't exist today that you'll be able to do. And so the lesson I took from my mom at 5 or 6 years old was don't let other people set your limits, right? Don't allow other people to put you in a label or a category that limits you, right? So this notion in my head, don't let other people set your limits, became like my operating system. And I just took it to heart. And so the problem was I took it too far. I took it as I did not have limits. So if you fast forward to like 11, I was told I wouldn't be able to play on the soccer team because I had these big, thick glasses. It's before the technology exists to be able to wear corrective lenses without harming yourself or other people. And eventually convinced them to let me play in goal because they wouldn't let me play on field. I let them play me in goal. I ended up being a pretty good goalkeeper. I just strapped glasses to the back of my head, and I would – sometimes save the ball with my face. I broke so many pairs of glasses. It was ridiculous. But I went on to be the captain of the team, and like we were a decent team, right? So I just built this. My brain got wired to, I'm going to win anyway. No matter what happens, I'm just going to find a way. No limits. So then I went get a bit older, and it's college time. And no one in my family grew up very working class. No one in my extended family had ever gone to college, right? It was unattainable for us. It wasn't expected. No one was pushing it. And I'm like, I could do college. Why? If other people can do college, why can't I do college? So figured out how to apply, did all that stuff, like on my own, like very scrappy. And instead of just going in and enrolling in just a regular degree, I mean, you know, I ended up enrolling physics with space science and systems. I'm like, I'm going to do college. Let's do rocket science, you know? So this is where it sort of takes a turn, because now I'm like, I am untouchable. Like, I came to the States, I started entry level, I was working my way through the company, I was like getting promoted, like just crushing life. And then in my late 20s, early 30s, I had a 2-year-old and a newborn baby. And I was at the point where my cone dystrophy had kicked in. So I was beginning to lose the acuity in my eyes and in the central vision. And I was learning to navigate the world through my periphery, and I should not have been driving. 100% in hindsight, I should have stopped driving by this point, because I'd worked hard to be able to drive. Yeah. Like, I'd done a lot of exercises with my eyes to get to 20/40 vision, and eventually was able to drive. And I remember it was a spring day evening, and I was coming home from work, my 2-year-old and my newborn in the back of the car in their car seats. And I was on the last road before I got to my house. And the sun was low in the sky, and it was spring, so there was a lot of pollen, and the windshield was kind of dirty, and I just could not see. Couldn't see. But I'm like sort of squinting, sort of trusting. I know the road. I know what I'm doing. Not going too fast, like 35 miles an hour. And I pull into the median to take a left into my neighborhood, like literally right at the doorstep of my neighborhood. And all of a sudden, there's a car broken down right in the median facing me. And I was feet away from this, feet away from a head-on collision that could have ended my life and my kid's life. And I slammed on the brakes, and I pulled the steering wheel as hard as I could. Luckily, there was no one to my side. And I literally missed this car by millimeters at most. Like, I don't know to this day, by the grace of God, whatever, but I didn't have a head-on collision. And I went home, got the kids out, sat in the kitchen for what feels like hours. Was probably only a few seconds or minutes, and my wife came in, and she could sense something was wrong, and she said, "What's wrong?" And I said, I'm not going to be able to drive anymore. I just almost killed myself and the boys, and it's not worth it, right? It's not worth it. And so she was totally cool. She's the best wife, and she understood, and she said, "We'll figure it out. It's not a problem." But I kind of went into a bit of a depression after this. Like, it was really hard, because for the first time since I was 5, something was telling me I couldn't do something.
Yeah.
You know? And so I spiraled a little bit. And it took me months to really come out of this. The hardest part, honestly, was going to the DMV the next year. I hadn't been out to drive for over a year, but my license was expiring. And so I had to give up my license, actually hand it in and get an ID instead. Right. And it's silly, but there's like the IDs in South Carolina. If you don't have a driver's license, there's a big photo and a small photo. And on a license, they're one side, and on an ID, they're the other. So now I'm different. I'm labeled as different. And I see labels as limits, right? So now I'm back in this space thinking, well, maybe my mom's wrong. Maybe there are limits. And maybe there are things I can't do. And so it really challenged me. And, you know, I'm not someone that sits around and is just going to let life happen to me. So I was doing a lot of research, trying to figure out the technology related to the condition I have. And I came across a journal, and the guy said, I don't remember who it was or what the journal was, but it said, people with this condition will have a reduced quality of life. And that just pissed me off so much. Like, to tell me that I was less than other people really, really bothered me. And so I spiraled a little more. And it wasn't until a few months later I came across a blog. It was an Australian girl called Chrissy who had a blog about Stargardt syndrome, which is another degenerative eye condition that actually completely takes your vision away. So you're essentially blind. And she would write in a real positive tone about how she navigated the world. And so I'd emailed her, and we'd had some conversations back and forth. And she said something that reminded me of a couple of things. And what she said was, listen, you're focused on the wrong thing, right? You're focused on the fact you can't drive, but you can still get where you're going to, right? You can get, and the purpose of driving is to get from point A to point B. You can still do that. You can get a ride from a friend. You can ride shares weren't really a thing quite yet, but you know, you can get where you're going to. Mm. So why are you focused on a limit, which isn't really a limit, right? And so it took me back to what I'd learned in physics, which was first principles thinking, right? Like strip back all your assumptions until you get to this indisputable truth, which is I need to get from place A to place B, and I can still do that. And I'm like, well, shit, I've been worried about this thing this whole time from the wrong perspective. And then I thought about what my mama said, right? This don't let other people put limits on you. And then I realized what I'd actually done is put a limit on myself.
Yeah.
So this is where, and Brad uses this phrase a lot, Brad Dean, who's been on the show, he uses this phrase, control what you can control, influence what you can influence, and don't worry about the rest, right? And that's the mindset. I didn't articulate it that way back then, but that's the mindset I shifted to. It was the combination of my physics degree and my mom that I was like, okay, let's just focus on controlling what we can control. And so this is where in the keynote, I sort of take a turn, right? So I've established me and I've established my background and why I think the way I do. But now I go in to talk about disruption. Before I do that, any comments you just want me to plow on?
No, I think, for one, it's kind of interesting to learn some of that about you when we've been friends for as long as we have. And
pretty private person.
Yeah, you know? I don't know a lot of that story.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of processing in real time here. It's funny, but before we continue, I think the one thing I'll say.
Yeah, it's funny. It's hilarious.
It's hilarious. and really, because we're on camera, I tried really hard not to laugh. No. What I was going to say is I think that what you're illustrating here, and I know we're going to get a little bit more into your point, mm-hmm. is that adversity has so much value to a human's life. Mm-hmm. And it's such a paradox with, especially you and I are both parents, and we've talked about this with our kids, that there's a big part of parenthood, which is trying to give your children a better life than you had. And in the process, you actually give them a worse life than you had because they can't overcome.
They don't get the hard knocks, right? You overprotect them and you don't let them learn and mistake. Our job as parents, as much as anything, is to teach our kids resilience. Kids don't get resilience these days.
Yeah.
And so letting them fail in low stakes environments is absolutely our job. And so when we do everything for them, we're actually doing them a disservice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My mom could have taken the opposite. She could have wrapped me up in cotton wool and not let me go out and potentially fail with the soccer team, but she didn't. She was like, no, you're just like the other kids. And so, you know, it's interesting. The first time I actually shared this story and why I actually ended up putting it in the keynote was we were doing an executive leadership team meeting recently where we were looking at the five dysfunctions of a team, which is a great book.
Yeah.
Everyone should read Five Dysfunctions. And it starts with trust. And so one of the trust exercises was we shared a bit about our childhood that influenced who we are, right? And I'm known in the office of kind of a pain in the ass, right? This,
really?
This concept of, are you surprised by this? In the office and via agencies, right? but never satisfied. I got this like win anyway, no matter what. Spirit, like, and I don't stop to celebrate. I'm always on to the next victory, right? And I shared this story with the team because I'm like, this is why I am the way I am, 100%. There's not a doubt in my mind that my environment and my mom's influence led me to be hyper-competitive, don't settle for anything, like, and do not tolerate excuses. Because there are people in this world where absolutely the world happens to them. And shit happens to everyone, right? It's how do we respond that really defines who you are and what your character is.
Yeah.
And so you can fall down and be crippled by life, the weight of life, or you can choose to resist and overcome, right? And so I'm someone that I don't have a lot of tolerance for people that don't try to overcome. It's a flaw of mine. I'm trying to work on it. I need to have more empathy. But so in the keynote, I turn, right, and I start talking about all the disruption that's coming. I show them a big word cloud of all the things that are happening and restate that massive disruption. If I'd had more time, I would have gone into the types of disruption that have happened in the past with the Industrial Revolution, when whaling industry was you know, obsolete overnight and stuff like that, but I had to cut it. But I told him, I was like, listen, my biggest fear as a hotelier would be that within the next few years, it's possible my website's irrelevant, I don't own my guests, and my job is obsolete. Like, that's a real possibility. And then I joked with him, and I said, and that's the end of the talk. I'm like, that would be the worst keynote ever. It's just like set up like the problem. But then I start talking about scrappiness, which is the point of this, right? So scrappiness means a lot of things. I think it's about mindset, right? I think scrappiness is about having a mindset, which is that win anyway mentality. And when I talk about scrappy, I'm not talking about doing more with less. I'm not talking about cutting corners. I'm not talking about winging it. That's not the kind of scrappy that, which does get used, that I'm talking about. So this is where I try to articulate what I mean by scrappy. So if you look at the dictionary, there's sort of two definitions of scrappy. One is feisty, like scrappy do, yeah. Feisty, right? Win anyway, almost a naive confidence to stuff. But what it is really is it's a willingness to try and a willingness to fail. Right, there's that side of what scrappy by definition means. Then the other is more made of scraps, like pieces of stuff, right? And in this context, I'm thinking of it more of, hey, having information or resources that aren't typical for my situation, looking outside of the box instead of inside the box, joining the dots that might not always be joined, right? Steve Jobs is a great example of this. Steve Jobs, before he dropped out of college, had to audit a calligraphy class. And it wasn't something he chose to do. He was put in to audit a calligraphy class. And he learned about the importance of design and aesthetics. And it wasn't until later when he met Steve Wozniak and they started building the first Macs that he was relentless about the importance of design and aesthetics in technology, in how design can improve the functionality of technology. Hmm. And so one of the sticking points later on was that the Mac needed different fonts. It couldn't just have a couple of standard computer fonts. It had to have serif and sans serif fonts. And all the technologists there, like the Steve Wozniaks and the nerds like me, were like, why? Like, we don't care about that stuff. But Steve Jobs was relentless because he'd learned from something outside years before, right? In that, Apple would just be another Dell today if it weren't for Steve Jobs having that outside perspective. And if you look back throughout different industries, some of the biggest innovations that have come from other industries have come from people that enter the industry from outside, right? It's happening with PGA right now. The PGA got a new – PGA Tour got a new CEO that came from another sport. And he's coming in and bringing that influence to the PGA. So often you need an outside perspective either that you've gathered as a scrap or you bring someone else's, right? So this is the creativity part of scrappy, right? So those are the two technical definitions. So what I've boiled those down to is first one is courage. You need to have the courage to try something and you need to have the imagination to wonder what could that thing be, right? And to be creative in joining the dots of what that could be. So that's my new definition of scrappy. It's a combination of courage and imagination. And what that leads to is you being able to challenge the status quo.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's the framework.
I like it.
Any response to that?
I would say that I agree with that definition, especially in the applicable sense, right? Like, okay, how do you use scrappiness in whether you're in your career or solving some other problem, right? I think the combination of courage and imagination is a pretty good definition. I like that.
Yeah.
Have you ever read the book by Michael Easter? It's called The Comfort Crisis.
I have not.
So it talks a lot about how as humans, we were originally, you know, designed to go out and hunt and to have to scavenge for our food when we needed to. And we were nomads in a lot of cases. And he talks about how because there's so much comfort in today's day and age, which is kind of funny because I think we also have more depression and anxiety and all those kind of things.
Because we have more comfort.
We haven't
built the resilience.
And it, again, it's that paradox, right? Mm-hmm. Of any time I'm comfortable, I'm actually not progressing or growing. And there's a switch inside of me as a human mm-hmm. that when I'm not progressing or growing, I'm unhappy because of that. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm not challenged, it's a bad thing. And so the whole point of...
Well, we always look for the enemy, right? We're always looking for the enemy. And if there's not a real enemy, that becomes an imagined enemy. Or something that would traditionally wouldn't be an enemy becomes an enemy.
Exactly. And so as I think about what you're saying, what you're actually providing is the...
Can I say, restate that? Threat is probably better than enemy.
Yeah, threat is better than enemy, for sure.
Yeah.
But what you're providing is essentially the antidote to a lot of the unhappiness, a lot of the disappointment that a lot of people feel because they're too comfortable. And mm-hmm. and yet your brain, like that's kind of a subconscious thing. What your brain actually tells you to do is the problem is you need more comfort. You need to work fewer hours in a mm-hmm. week. You need to, you know, sleep more. You need to get more sleep. You're not getting enough sleep. And so on and so forth. Like your brain is going to tell you need more comfort when the antidote is to be scrappy.
You need to eat more food because you get the endorphin hit. You know, you need to scroll more on TikTok because you get the endorphin.
You need a break.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you earn it. Yeah. So I don't think scrappy alone, that framework works on its own because it could get – it's a little woo-woo, right?
Sure.
Just on its own. So I think you need a couple
I'm sorry?
A little woo-woo, right? Like just out there. You're looking at me like that's a bad word. Does that mean something?
If I heard somebody refer to a little woo-woo.
Yeah, it's not sexual, so don't even try to
get it. Sexual.
I don't know where you're going with this. Like it just means out there, right? Like
yeah.
Hippy-dippy. Is that
oh, hippy-dippy. Is that well, better? Why didn't you say so?
Okay. What would you call? What's yours?
I'm still trying to figure out what you're trying to say. No, you mean it's just kind of like ambiguous.
Yeah.
Right? And, to put it in like adult not, terms.
Ambiguous, but also like a little bit of fake science. Like it's not real, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Also a little woo-woo.
Yeah, exactly. Hippy-dippy. So I think the first piece of the framework that you have to have is whatever your profession is, you need to be obsessed with the customers you're serving, right? The decisions you make within this framework have to be in their interest, not your own interest, mm-hmm. right? With hotels, that's the guest. But it also extends to your coworkers, right? Because if your relationships were better. So I think to be obsessed with the people you serve has to be at the top of any decision tree that you make. That's like the prerequisite that you're making decisions. The example I gave them was like there are hotel GMs that sit behind a spreadsheet. And they can look really good in the short term because they'll save money, right? They'll go and they'll say, well, we'll cut the hours on the pool deck or we'll use cheaper soap or we'll cut the quality of the linens because it's a little cheaper. But sooner or later, what happens is your P&L looks good for the first 6-12 months, but then people will begin to notice and they'll say, this experience didn't meet my experience, right, or my expectations, or it's not as good as it used to be. I'm less likely to come back. I'm less likely to tell my friends. I'm less likely to leave a review that the rest of the world can see. And so it has a trickle-down effect that essentially means your demand decreases over time. And now your costs have gone down, but also your revenue, and eventually that's a doom spiral.
Yeah.
And so the best GMs in hotels are the ones that spend a lot of time in the lobby, on the pool deck, interacting with the guests, talking to them, understanding their needs, meeting their needs. Like an example, I was actually at this conference, and one of the people were talking about how great the hospitality was at the hotel. It was the Ellie Beach Resort in Myrtle Beach. And I said, well, can you give me an example? And they said, yeah, one of our attendees has a CPAP machine and forgot to bring distilled water. It's 9 o'clock at night. You know, what can we do about it? But some hotels would say, hey, there's a grocery store down the corner. Yeah. The GM actually went out and got some distilled water and brought it back and bought some extra so that they have some handy if other people need it.
That's great.
Right? No inconvenience for them. Didn't charge them for it. It was a surprise and delight moment that person's going to talk about to 50 people.
Yep.
Right? And so that's the hospitality piece in hotels. And I think it can be with us too, with our members or how we're structured. But you've got to be obsessed with the people you serve. Like the decision you make has to be that. So I think that was a scrappy solution to the problem because they were focused on that. So I think that's the first one. The second is this stuff's not easy, right? Being scrappy can create the feeling that literally is pain to some people.
Yeah.
Like doing something new is painful. And I had a mentor when I was in my early mid-20s. His name was Jib Woodring. He's since passed. But he was a big influence on me. He came from retail into the golf space, and he had a lot of disruption. He's really single-handedly, I think, changed the golf package environment. He invented digital, being out of book, room, and golf together here in Myrtle Beach. He was the first guy to do it because he came from retail. So that's another example of Scrappy. But he would get me to do the most asinine, laborious tasks, like looking through and sorting through all this data to find insights, and it was took so much time. And we would occasionally find insights that were valuable that we could apply, right? And it made iterative improvements for us. And one day I said to him, Jim, this is so much work. We don't need to do this. And he said, that's the reason we need to do it, because it is so much work. I know that our competition is not going to do it. We should be willing to do more than our competition is willing to do. The hard stuff is what will differentiate us. And I always took that to heart. And so we internally refer to this as a cute little phrase, right? And I had a nice slide with this too. We call it hugging the cactus.
Okay.
So if someone's complaining that they want to do, that we need to do something, but it's too much work or it's hard or I've never done it before, we say, just hug the cactus. Hug the cactus. Like embrace the difficulty of it, because the benefits of that are going to be clear in the end. So you have to be scrappy, you got to learn to hug the cactus. You got to be comfortable being uncomfortable, because 60-70% of the time you're doing stuff, you're uncomfortable with it because it's not stuff you've done before. So you got to develop this resilience in your brain to say, I'm willing to try the things I've not tried before. So that's the second piece.
Okay.
Anything there?
No, I kind of want to hear the rest, and then what I'd like to do is narrow into DMOs specifically and like, okay, how do we apply this?
We're going to get there, all right? So there's two types of ways to approach Scrappy in my mind. One is a top-down approach. One is a bottom-up approach, right? So think bottom-up is first principles. So first principles we've already established is when you strip things down, you eliminate the assumptions, and you get to something that's indisputable. And so the example I gave with them was the Fuel Hotel Marketing Podcast, which is my podcast before we did this one when I was on the hotel side.
Your second favorite podcast you've ever done.
My most successful podcast I've ever done. Yeah. So this is 2014, 2015. Serial had just come out. Podcasts were just beginning to hit the mainstream. We were all listening to podcasts in our world. And we had a problem. The problem was that paid media wasn't as effective as it used to be. It was really hard for a small agency to continue to spend money on paid media effectively with a good ROI. And so we needed a different approach, a scrappy approach. And so we went back to first principles and we said, well, what does our customer need, right? We said, where are they and where can we reach them? And so we said, well, what would we need to do to have a podcast? We'd not done a podcast before. No one really had done it. There was one or two in the hotel space that weren't successful, and we'd listen to them, and they were awful. Just boring, drivel, like very vanilla, like just not, no value to it, right? And so we said, right, if we're going to do a podcast, we know we have the content, right, because we've already having these conversations in our office. So we know we could record that. But what's the insight? What's the leverage point that we can lean into that's going to differentiate us? And we came to the realization that we looked at what podcast people were actually listening to, and we said, well, it's things like Serial, it's things like This American Life, it was things like Planet Money at the time. So it was like, oh, what do they all have in common? Well, they're providing value and information, but they're also entertaining. We enjoy listening to them, right? I feel like I'm a part of the show, like it's, because we know podcasting is a very intimate medium, right? It's almost like our desties are sitting in the room with us when we're talking, right? We address them directly. And so we had that insight and we said, well, okay, now we got that leverage point. We know that the first principle is we got to develop content that is both valuable in terms of the subject matter, but also entertains people because we're competing with these other folks. And so we already had this sort of swag. We're all in our 20s or 30s, and we called ourselves Fueligans. We thought we were funny, and we still think we're funny.
I was going to say, right? Yeah, that hasn't changed.
So we just tried it, and we said, what's the worst that can happen? The worst thing that can happen, you've said this before, the worst thing that happens if you start a podcast is no one listens.
Right? Yeah.
And so the barrier to entry was essentially zero. We spent $80 on a mic, a Yeti mic, and stuck. We didn't even each have an individual mic. We had one mic in the middle of a table. $80 was our dollar investment. And then we had I spent 3 hours on YouTube watching videos on how to record, what software to use, that kind of stuff. So 3 hours and $80, and we just started recording. And the first one didn't go great. I mean, it was rough. The hardest part, this is where I encourage people to hug the cactus, the hardest part was hitting record on the first episode.
Yeah.
Once we hit record on the first episode, I was so nervous. I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I had all this doubt in my head that what if we fail? What if? But we did it anyway. We hugged the cactus, right? And we pushed through. And 5 years later, we'd been the number one podcast in hotel industry for five straight years. We had 10x'd our leads. We had reduced our conversion rate, or reduced the time of onboarding by 50%. Like, it was, and we ended up selling the agency in part because of the growth we'd seen because of this podcast. So an $80 investment. We went on and spent another probably $600-$700 on better equipment after about 30 episodes.
But that's after it became a thing.
After it was valuable to us and there was an ROI, right? But that's that sort of first principles ground up. And it started with this first principles idea of what's most important to the customer. Like, that was the question we wanted to solve. And the insight was they need to be entertained, not just educated.
Yeah, one of the things I want to point out on this is in our innate desire for comfort, I think a lot of times what we do is make excuses for not trying or starting something because we pretend that it's because it's a barrier, but what it actually is a desire to not change.
Self-preservation, right? It's a form of protection.
Yeah.
Because anytime there's risk, there's potential harm, and when there's harm, then we're going to try to avoid it.
But you just said the hardest thing to do was press record on the first episode.
Yep.
Why? Because everything before that was, in theory, what are the problems we could run into?
Mm-hmm.
But then once you press play, it's a thing that can evolve based on the experience that you're having or what you're learning along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually don't learn anything until you start whatever the thing is, the scrappy thing that you're going to do. And so all the discomfort you felt leading up to it, all the analysis paralysis and stuff that was happening until then was all theory. And the moment you put it into practice, it's not theory, it's learning.
Yeah.
And you can't learn until you try.
Yeah, it's true. And I think the real risk came once we published, right? But because it exposes us, right? Once we put things out into the ether, then we open ourselves up to criticism. We open ourselves up to being exposed as frauds. You know, everyone has imposter syndrome. So what if I'm not as smart as I think I am? What if people think I'm stupid? What if I say something stupid, you know? Like, that's the threat in something like a podcast. Obviously, you and I have kind of got past that because we've both done other podcasts, and now we'll say any ridiculous stuff.
Yeah. Plus, we've said so much stupid stuff, it's hard to find the stupidest thing you ever said.
It's a signal and noise thing in our advantage, right?
Yeah.
There's so much stuff out there. But I think this first principles thinking is something we try to apply to a lot of our projects here, where it's like, how do we go back to the original? Mutari Best is another example of a campaign where we went back to first principles, you know? Another one is the queue in Myrtle Beach,
yeah.
You know? So there's tons of them. So that's one. The other is – so that's the bottom-up approach for being scrappy. The other is the top-down, right? And the top down is what I've referred to before in the show. I'm not the only one who uses this phrase, but cathedral thinking.
Yep.
Like you think of something so big and beautiful that's going to take a long time, but eventually it's going to be brilliant. And even if you don't get all the way to the end, just making headway towards it is positive movement. And so with us, obviously, it was the whole autism and sensory-friendly mm-hmm. travel stuff, right? When I came to this job – almost 5 years ago, I knew that the Myrtle Beach area was sensory friendly. We'd done a lot of work here. Champion Autism Network had done a ton of work here. And we had a good experience, right? But not enough people were enjoying it. And then I came across that stat that I've talked about on the show before, that 87% of families who have a member on the autism spectrum don't travel. And so I'm like, this is not acceptable. Like, we need to make a dent in the university. Like, we need to fix that number. Like, if Myrtle Beach benefits from it, great. But that's not the reason we're going to do this. We're going to, the cathedral we're building is we're going to unlock travel for millions of people. The 1 in 33 people that are now diagnosed with autism, the 75 million families living with autism today. And so we said, we can't do that on our own and we can't do it all at once. So let's start with cathedral thinking. It's about how do I lay a foundation today that I can build off of?
Yeah.
And we need to think it that way right now because say we're building, we had this conversation earlier today, say we're building a new website. We don't know what the future is for websites. So why would I build a static traditional website today, not without the agility to know where it's going to go? So we built this into at autism, a sensory friendly thing. But like any big project, I'm a believer, whether you're doing a brand rollout, whether you're communicating anything, you start inside and you work out, right? So with our autism awareness stuff, we wanted to start internally within Myrtle Beach. So we developed the Sensory Friendly Pledge was the first thing. Very low lift for us. We said, hey, businesses, we'd love for you to just to say, hey, I'm on the team and I want better resources for people with autism or neurodiversity. And so we got a couple hundred businesses signed up for that. And then we said, okay, now you're committed. We want some of you to train your frontline staff. You know, some already had, but some hadn't. So we got, I think, close to 2,000 total frontline workers have been trained at this point on how to recognize autism, how to cater to needs and things like that. But more importantly, we turned that into an earned media thing where we're like, hey, we're sending a signal to the world that Myrtle Beach is open and ready for business and we're committed to this, right? So that was sort of first foundation. But then we're like, okay, well, now we need to communicate more with the autism community and we need something that we can talk about with the autism community. I don't even remember who came up with this. We're like, what about a children's book, right? And we're like, well, do we know how to make a children's book? Like, have we done, we've not done this before. Our agencies haven't done this before. And most DMOs would go to the agency and say, let's make a children's book. And it would be very self-promotional. Yep. And we said, absolutely not. We're building a cathedral. We're doing the long game here. I don't care how long it takes. My non-negotiables were, this has to be someone that's already an author that knows how to write children's books. We're not going to have our agencies write it. We're not going to write it. It needs to be someone that is connected to autism. They understand autism.
Yeah. Right?
And it needs to be someone that loves Myrtle Beach. And that last one was probably a wild card, but we were like, this would be important to us. And it literally took us over 7 months because that Venn diagram of those three things is very small, right? And
yeah.
We eventually found Linda and her son, Tyler, who is on the spectrum. They'd been coming to Myrtle Beach for 20 years. She'd already written children's books targeting the autism community. And she was an illustrator, which was a bonus. And so she could actually illustrate the book. And we told her the first conversation we had is, hey, we want to pay you to write a book, but we want you to write the book. We're not going to write the book. We're going to sort of look at it and we may give you some feedback, but we want it to be your book. We don't want it to be a promotion of Myrtle Beach. We want it to be set in Myrtle Beach, but we want it to have the purpose of helping children and parents cope with the stresses of travel, like identifying the problems, the barriers, and to address those in the book. So that was the brief. And she wrote an amazing book. We took time. We went back and forth. We changed some things. But we created Splish Splash Squawk, Finding Joy in a Sensory Friendly Vacation, available now on Amazon if anyone wants to read it. But it took, like, literally start to finish, probably close to 2 years for that project, you know? Didn't have to spend a ton of money, you know. It wasn't insignificant, but all in, it was probably less than $10,000, you know, to get this project done. But then we took the real big swing, right, which was obviously traveling the spectrum.
Yeah.
And
season two out this week.
Season two is about to launch. Season one now available on YouTube, by the way. So anyone, because it was on Peacock before, but now, and season one's still on Peacock. Season one is now available on YouTube. You just search for Traveling the Spectrum or go to the Beach Easy YouTube channel. But we'd never really done much with TV. We dabbled with a couple of shows, but we didn't know how to go about this. So we partnered with someone that did. This is where the scrappy comes in. We went and found someone that had that scrap we needed, the ability to make the TV show. We didn't have the hubris to think we could do it on our own. So we brought in experts. In the case of Linda with the book, the workshop with Traveling the Spectrum. And we believed in it so much that we built the show before we had a distribution strategy.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of the courage and imagination part in action. We had just stupid belief that we would get there. And I literally spent over a year talking to Netflix and Amazon and Peacock and all these streaming services and just getting door after door slammed in my face, like repeatedly. They're like, it's great. We love it. It's just not what we're looking for. And it was heartbreaking. And I think other organizations would have given up at some point, right? But we refused to give up. This is the courage piece, right? We said, we're going to keep going. And then one random day, we got to the right person at Peacock through pure persistence and relentlessness. We found a person at Peacock that had a connection to autism. Mm. And she said, I love it. We can publish within 3 months. And we're actually going to pay you to publish it. But it took that scrappy mentality, that naive confidence that I was talking about, to just be relentless in our pursuit that this was what we needed. And so eventually, you know, the rest is history. Traveling Spectrum became a phenomenon. We got all these awards, Emmy nominated, all these accolades. And more importantly, the data I've seen more recently on how many people with autism don't travel, the numbers have dropped precipitously. And I'm not saying it's just us, right? I think we're a part of a movement. We catalyze, we encourage. There's a lot of other destinations have really done a good job. Mesa, Arizona, some places in North Carolina have really done a good job around sensory friendly. But I got to believe in my heart that in part we influenced some of these folks, right? We encouraged them to strive even more and make more noise about it.
Well, think about that, though, because you said, well, I imagine maybe we made a difference. But this is the thing about having the courage to start the project is how many influencers did we get involved in sharing season one when it came out?
Yeah,
how many
tons.
I mean, the families that were in the video, we changed those individual lives for
every
sure.
Every one of them, yeah. And now we've shot three seasons, you know. So those nine families' lives have changed forever. Every one of them left a different person, you know.
Yeah.
And in the talk, I actually show a video of – so one of the families in season two, they have a young daughter called Mila. And the mom, after she left, posted on Instagram a video just – unbelievable response to how her family and especially her daughter felt like they belong, felt like they actually weren't judged, that they had a place that was safe and that they could be normal, quote unquote normal, you know? And so even that one family would have made it all worth it, right? But it wasn't just that one family. It was the nine families. They all fundamentally changed the direction of their lives. Plus the thousands of emails we've received from families that say this has inspired them and that they're willing to take a risk on a vacation now that they weren't before. Plus the millions of people that haven't reached out, right? So we know that this one was a cathedral there's no doubt in my mind that when I retire, this will be the project that I'm most proud of, you know?
So when I give speeches at conferences and I talk about being willing to take a risk and do something different,
yeah.
One of the things that's kind of fun is I show that trailer as an example of a destination that did something different.
Yeah.
People clap at the end
every single time. It's amazing.
Every single time.
So I think that the lesson here, and this is a lesson for scrappy people, is sometimes you need to ask why not, right? Sometimes when you say, hey, let's make a TV show or let's make a children's book, too often DMOs are going to say, why? That's not what we do. You know, but we need to start asking why not more. We need to have the courage and the imagination to say why not.
And why not us?
Exactly. And you need to instill that in your team because you've definitely got to have some devil's advocates in your team to stop you doing stupid stuff. this is off track a little bit, but in my previous job, we had a kind of an eccentric owner. Where maybe I get some of it. He was a good mentor of mine. And there was a period where Myrtle Beach had a couple of shark attacks in like a space of a week or whatever. And it was big news because everyone gets excited about that. Even though, fun fact, more people die every year from vending machines falling on them than from shark attacks. That's actually true. But his idea was, let's give people a reward because it's so unlikely that we'll have another shark attack. Let's pay a $10,000 reward for anyone that gets bitten in the next 7 days in Myrtle Beach. And I'm like, that's one where you ask, that's probably not a good idea. Why would we do that? Because people are going to go.
The incentives.
Yeah, the incentives. I would do a lot of crazy stuff for $10,000. So you can imagine people like cutting their legs or putting meat on their leg or whatever. Anyway,
Heard it here first. Stuart will do just about anything for $10,000.
You're right, I would. The ask why not is important, and surrounding yourself with people that ask why not is important for scrappy people to be successful. So this is where I sort of laid the table, but then I related it to, in this case, Newport. And I talked a lot to them about changing their mindset for the upcoming conference and pointing out that the scraps piece, the joining the dots piece, I used to do conferences wrong. I used to go to conferences and I'd go to all of the sessions of the stuff that I was most interested in, mm-hmm. and that I knew the most about. So I'd go to the marketing track, right? And I'd go there and I'd be bored because it was all stuff I already knew, you know. Or it would make me feel good sometimes because it was reinforcing what my conceptions. But I wasn't learning, right? So now when I go to conferences, I try to go to the ones that I know least about or the ones I'm less interested in, because I don't know when I'm going to find information that's going to be useful that I can join the dots, right? So I think that was one thing I told them. And I also asked them a question, how many of you are in marketing, right? And this is an audience of GMs and sales folks and all the people you would admit. And like maybe 10% of them put their hand up that they're in marketing. I said, you're wrong, guys. Every one of you should have your hand up right now. And then I talked about our conversations we've had about what is the brand, right? The brand is – we're slightly different on this. Yeah. You've talked about it being the touch points, the sum of the touch points. I think it's the sum of the delta between the touch points and the expectations. And I went into detail about what I meant by that. And then by the end, I'm like, so now how many people are in marketing? And everyone went up, because I was talking about – real experiences. When you come to the check-in desk and you've been driving 9 hours, yeah. and your wife's grumpy at you, your kids are wailing, you expect, you know, friendly service, you expect a timely process, you expect your room to be ready, you expect that room to be clean. Like, there's all these touch points that different people have had an influence on, IT, front desk, housekeeping, whatever, GM, that is all related to marketing. Because if you get those wrong, those steps wrong, and the expectations aren't met, then people are less likely to return. They're less likely to tell their friends. They're less likely to leave reviews. And so you're all in marketing, and they're like, get it. And then going through what else? So then I reintroduced that framework. So the framework to reset it for our desties is scrappiness is a mindset that everyone has to have, because it's the only way to be agile enough moving forward with all the disruption that's happening. And as a reminder, scrappiness is the combination of courage and imagination that leads to challenging the status quo through the lens of being obsessed with the customer, and then don't forget to hug the cactus. So that's that's the full framework. And then I sort of went and tied it into I usually end on like going back to the don't let other people set your limits, like that kind of inspirational stuff. And then I would talk about something like a Qui-Gon Jinn quote, like your focus determines your reality. But in fact, with these guys, with Newport Hospitality, they had one of their founders who'd passed away a couple of years ago. He had come up with this quote, and I thought it was pretty cute, but it is, life is a bouquet of consequences. And so basically, and that's good and bad, right?
Yeah.
And so your life is a bouquet of consequences. And so the decisions we make, the things we focus on, the things we choose to put our time and energy in can either end up with beautiful roses or something pretty pitiful, right? And so then I finished on a big bouquet of flowers and said, and don't forget, scrappiness always wins. And then it was the house came down and everyone was hugging, crying, and high-fiving, and you know, it felt really good.
Yeah.
But that's the framework, man.
So, I like it.
Yeah. Push back. Tell me where
I'm
wrong.
Well, I don't even know that I would necessarily push back, because I think scrappiness is what we're going to need to be successful in the next 5 years. With the way technology is changing, you and I have talked a lot. Is a website even going to be tomorrow what a website is today?
No.
Unequivocally. Yeah. Is marketing even going to be a thing with the channels that are happening, and there's so much that's going to change. The only thing I can guarantee to anyone is that it's going to change. Yeah. And those that have scrappiness instilled within them are going to be prepared for change.
Yeah.
And those that don't, won't. And I actually want to tell you about one of my biggest leadership failures, if that's okay.
So, anytime I hear what you failed, it's great. So.
Perfect. So in 2016, I bought the agency from the previous owner that eventually became Brand Revolt. And when I bought it, we went through the process of developing our core values, our mission, and all that kind of stuff. And core values for me, when I did it, one of the things that I said was a non-negotiable, because we involved the team in the creation of these core values, but one of the things that I said was a non-negotiable was scrappy. That had to be one of our core values. And about 2 or 3 years later, I actually had a woman come to me, and she said, in our organization, right? And she said that she felt like scrappy was inappropriate because it had male connotation, right? And she felt like it
she was thinking of the feisty side, like getting
It was really masculine is kind of how she felt. And it was also at the time where I think socially there was a lot of fear of any kind of, you know, oppression or anything like that. And so I didn't have the courage to stay with the core value that I felt most passionate about if I was going to be leading an organization. And we changed it. And
what'd you change it to?
To be honest with you, I don't remember because we've updated them since. Yeah. But I just remember being so disappointed in myself, so disappointed in the organization. And I actually, the organization became less scrappy.
Yeah.
Like it when you remove it as one of the core tenets, you lose it.
You're giving permission to people to not do it, you know.
And if I could go back, that's one of the key things that I would change is I would never have let scrappy disappear.
Did you define it for them?
We did.
When you said scrappy, like how did you define it back then?
We defined it as being extremely resourceful and nimble.
Yeah.
And that's kind of and I actually like the courage and imagination combination even better, but it was resourceful and nimble was the key thing that we had to be willing to break down whatever barriers to figure things out.
Yeah.
And we lost that. And it's actually taken years to get back to the point where I feel like I've rebuilt a fully scrappy team.
Yeah, your team's very scrappy. It's one of the reasons we like working with them. I'd say more scrappy than most agencies, for sure.
It's taken a lot of rebuilding to get there. Because once you let scrappiness be lost as a cultural element.
Yeah,
your organization can't.
Well, if you pay me $10,000, I'll come and I'll inspire them all with my framework of what scrappy is. So
we were hoping to have you.
Anything for $10,000.
Yeah, we wanted to watch you strap some meat to your leg instead. I'll bring the whole team out, and you go stand in the ocean with some meat on your leg. This is what scrappy is, guys.
Yeah, this ain't form of scrappy. Yeah, I'll tell you another version of a bad idea that same guy had off. Yeah, because there was some crazy ones. Well, thank you for indulging me. This is good. I just, you know, and I'd love the destination to weigh in too, what they think about this framework. And again, it's courage plus imagination, which leads to willingness and almost permission to challenge the status quo, being obsessed with the customer, and don't forget to hug the cactus. That's the framework.
And for everybody that's listening, I want to say I endorse this as your message. Mm-hmm.
However?
No. However coming.
Okay.
If every single member of the destination marketing industry is not scrappy in the next 3 years, organizations will be damaged and jobs will be lost.
Yeah.
And I just can't stress enough, we're past the point of talking softly about this. There's a reason this is your keynote right now, and there's a reason it makes a lot of impact, is because scrappiness is what's going to help people be nimble enough to have a professional career in the next 5 years.
Yeah, you and I were in a meeting yesterday with a DMO, it's a golf-specific DMO here in Myrtle Beach. And we talked a lot about the need for agility, right? Agility, because we don't know what's coming. Don't forget, there's the two forms of scrappy that we talked about, or at least the approaches, one being ground up, one being top down, and the ground up being the first principles one. That's the one, because I don't think everyone's got the resources or going to be able to necessarily do the cathedral thinking thing. You know, we're in a very fortunate position in Visit Myrtle Beach. I don't think you should not do it because it's hard, though, right, to be clear. I just think right now the priority for most DMOs should be this ground up first principles.
Yeah.
Like, why do we do what we do? Like, and what assumptions are we just assuming a fact when they're really not? They're just, we've always done it this way. Like, if there's anything, any program that you've done, like even an event that you hold for your members, hey, are we doing this event this way because we've always done it? Well, why not change it? Why not think about it from a customer's point of view? Like, why not say, what did they want? And if you don't know what they want, go talk to them.
Yeah.
And ask them what they want, because we're no different than that GM. Like, if we spend all of our time behind the spreadsheet and not interfaced with our and integrated and having conversations with our guests, or in our case, our stakeholders, we're never going to know what their thoughts and their desires are. So
yeah,
go be scrappy, destination. I feel like they're scrappy. They're listening to the show. That's a part of it, right? It's collecting the scraps of information that we're giving them.
Yeah, share the show with those that aren't scrappy.
Yeah, and put a scrappy subject line in the email. Tell them they need to be scrappy. Go be scrappy, people.
I like it.
I will say this. I'll tell you, like, this is not a new concept for me. I've articulated it differently. But I wrote maybe the first blog I ever wrote when I was a project manager at Fuel, before I did the podcast, before I really had any career success. I'd probably hired by this point a dozen people over, like, several years. And some had washed out. Some had worked out really well. Some of them to this day are my best friends, right? The single determining factor on whether they were going to be successful or not with that organization and with this organization at Visit Myrtle Beach is how scrappy they were.
Yeah.
Didn't matter what experience they had. Didn't matter what education they had. Scrappy was everything. It was all about attitude, you know? Were they willing to have the courage and the imagination and willing to do the hard thing and challenge the status quo? And so hire for scrappy today. You know, that you should be testing their resilience. You should be testing their creativity, testing their courage during the interview process. Because if you don't hire scrappy people, you're not going to be able to be scrappy as an organization. And so we hire for scrappy.
I'm in.
Awesome. Scrappy Nation.
Yeah.
Actually, this is funny. I actually own the domain name scrappynation.com.
There's the sales pitch. Guys, watch for the website going up.
It does not exist. I have not done anything with it. Many, many years ago, I started writing a book called Scrappy Marketing. Huh. And but I didn't do a good enough job back then articulating what scrappy was. And I've got a couple of chapters done. I might revisit it. But I'd registered scrappynation.com like probably 10, 15 years ago. So, yeah. There's no sales pitch. I'm not Adam. We didn't reverse roles today. Well, Adam, any final thoughts from you?
I know
we've been going long.
I really enjoyed it. It's fun to learn more about your background, too, and some of the things that you've been through. It gives me some new perspective on why you are the way that you are.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it. I'm sure that for a keynote, there's not an organization right now that doesn't need to hear that message.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. The problem is I got a day job. I don't really do keynotes. So it just happened to be this one in Myrtle Beach. But it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so maybe next episode you can share your childhood with us.
I would love to share my childhood trauma with you next time.
All right. Well, stay tuned for the next episode where Adam Stoker reveals all. Adam, they want to find you. Where can they do it?
Find me, Adam, at thebrandrevolt.com. You can find me on LinkedIn or, of course, on Tourism IQ.
Of course on Tourism IQ. Why do you say of course?
Because it is the place where everyone goes in the destination marketing space to get news, information, and education. And the cool thing is, we've really ramped up the volume of content over the last couple of weeks on Tourism IQ.
So is it AI written slop?
It's not AI written slop.
Okay,
it's
good.
AI curated.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
I will make a commitment to you that I will write a blog post.
On scrappiness?
On scrappiness, and I will post it. And I will put myself on a timeline by the time this episode comes out. Okay. How about that?
We got 7 in the queue, so.
No, not that many. But I could also just not publish this episode until I write
that
the
article. That sounds great.
Yeah. So in 12 months, when you're listening to this episode, that article will be there on Tourism IQ. Adam, thank you, man. I appreciate you indulging me today. If you want to find me, Stuart.Butler at visitmodelbeach.com, please leave a review and share this episode with a friend. We're really seeing some massive growth in the audience, and we want to continue that. But there's not a person in the DMO space doesn't need to hear some of these hard conversations. And everyone I'm talking to, because a lot of people give us feedback, they're all saying that, one, I'm funnier than you are, Adam, but two, that every episode, they're getting something out of it, right? And so I think we're doing...
I believe half of what you said.
That's good. but we're doing, we're living that thing that I talked about with the Fuel podcast, right? We're trying to be entertaining and educational. Hopefully people find us mildly humorous. I know I do. But leave us a review. And until next time, this has been Destination Discourse.
Thanks, everybody. You ever thought about how grateful you should be to the person that told you when you were 5 years old of what you couldn't do?
I haven't. That's a really good question. I've always been grateful for my mom.
Yeah. She played a role.
Yeah. Well, but, she was probably the protagonist.
Well, no,
but the antagonist is probably...
I've really been trying to think lately that the people we view as the negative guardrails in our life, the people who created that negative boundary that we pushed against.
They created the
situation that caused us to be great. And again, it just goes back to adversity. Like the value of adversity is something that I've just been really focused on lately.
Make sure your kids understand that before they leave the house.
Yeah.
99% of kids today don't realize that.
Funny story, just real quick, and I know that I'm operating in a quasi-recorded state here. But we were on spring break last week, and my daughter wanted me to go on a water park ride with her. Mm-hmm. And we're standing in line, and I was telling her how grateful I am for the adversity that she has to go through and the hard things she has to go through, because I think it's so important. I've been on this kick, right?
Yeah.
And she just looks at me, and she goes, "I can't believe you would say that." And I said, "I promise you, I believe it. 100%. Yeah. I'm so glad you're going through the hard things
you're going through. You may not understand it now,
but
you will appreciate it. Yeah, that's great parenting.
And I'm glad you're going through the hard things you're going through, Stuart.
I'm not really going through too many hard things right now, man.
That was for the ending.
Okay. That's hilarious.